From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Scientists created and tested coronavirus vaccines in record time, but getting those shots actually into American arms is happening much more slowly. For example, by the end of last year, the Trump administration said 20 million Americans would have received their first dose of coronavirus vaccine. Instead, just 3 million did. Now efforts are ramping up in states across the country, including New Hampshire, where as of Friday, 62,000 people had received at least their first shot of vaccine. Today in The Exchange, two top state officials involved in vaccination efforts join us. So get your questions in now, Exchange listeners. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. And our phone number is 800-892-6477. Joining us is Dr. Beth Daly, Chief of the Bureau of Infectious Disease Control at the New Hampshire Department of Health and Human Services. Dr. Daly, thank you very much for being with us. We really appreciate it.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And also with us, Kirsten Dersey. She's evaluator for the Bureau, a member of the COVID-19 Vaccine Allocation Strategy Branch, and of the Governor's Equity Response Team. And Kirsten, welcome back. Good to have you too. Thank you.
Good morning, Laura. Thank you for having us.
Well, Dr. Daly, has the state of New Hampshire received all the vaccines expected from the federal government? Because there seems to be some new confusion at the federal level, where the Health and Human Services Secretary says, just in the past couple of days, there is no stockpile. It's a concerning situation. So could you tell us about the federal supply, please, Dr. Daly?
Yes. So thank you for bringing this issue up. We know that this has created quite a bit of confusion by the public as well as our partners. Last week, the federal HHS had made an announcement that they were going to be releasing the stockpile of COVID-19 vaccine to the states and that we should expect to see a significant increase in the allocation made to New Hampshire and the vaccine doses coming into the state. But this has not transpired from our perspective. We have been receiving around 17,000 doses of vaccine each week to provide those first dose administrations to the public. And at this point, that is the amount of vaccine that we're continuing to receive right now. We have not received any notice from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention that we're receiving an increased amount of vaccine. So that has not transpired as we had hoped or had expected it might. At this point, we're basically receiving stable amounts of vaccine, although we do hope that it will increase over time based on manufacturer increases, as well as the potential to bring on new formulations of the vaccine. So we're very hopeful that we'll receive more vaccine, but right now that those amount of doses that we're receiving is our limiting factor in terms of how quickly we're able to vaccinate the public.
Wow. And many other states, Dr. Daly, as you well know, had a similar response to you. They had ramped up the number of people who were going to soon be eligible. People were getting pretty excited. And then this news from the federal government that a fresh supply will not be coming. So will the state be able to proceed with this ambitious plan to start registering people for vaccines who are over age 65? This is the new phase that we're moving into.
Right. We are going to proceed with our plan. And on Friday, January 22nd, anyone 65 and older will be able to come to our state website, vaccines.nh.gov, to register themselves to receive vaccine at an open clinic within the state.
So people can register, and just fingers crossed that this supply chain will expand. Is that what you're saying, Dr. Daly?
Well, we will schedule them in for a clinic beginning on January 26th. Now, it could take many weeks, of course, for us to be able to vaccinate all the individuals that are in that group. It's around 250,000 or so people in our state who are 65 and older. With only receiving 17,000 vaccines per week, that is going to take us sometimes a couple months to be able to get through all those individuals if 100% of them want to be vaccinated. So people will be able to register, but they're going to have to be patient in terms of when they're going to get their slot in our vaccine scheduling.
Kirsten, I'd love your perspective too. What more does the state of New Hampshire need from the federal government?
I think that one of the things that has been really increasingly clear over time is that in a time like this, when sort of fear is something that all of us carry with us, you know, every day, all day, that anytime there's mixed messaging or messaging that doesn't necessarily line up or information that's shared that doesn't pan out, it can become very confusing for people, and it can certainly instill a lack of trust. And I think that one thing that we've been working really hard to do here in New Hampshire is be as clear as we can, when we can, about what our plans are, what led to our allocation decisions, and how we're going to ensure that we are meeting the needs of all of the people in New Hampshire, especially the most vulnerable populations.
What's that been like for you, Kirsten? You know, I appreciate what you're saying. You're trying to get clarity to people when people are understandably nervous. And yet, you know, at the federal level, the messages keeps changing. So how do you kind of stay on top of that for folks?
You know, I think we continue to do the things that we've done over many years. We just do them a little more intensively and more frequently, which is to really ensure that, you know, we have a clear message internally that we're able to push outward. And then maybe most importantly, that we recognize that, in our state, as in most states, our Division of Public Health is one partner in the mix. And we have lots and lots of other partners out there who we rely on to help share information and to help, you know, to help quell fears where they exist. And so I think that we continue to ramp up our ability to share information with our partners, and our non-traditional partners, our community members, our advocacy groups, our, you know, individual family members, so they can in turn share it with their circle of family and friends. And that's one way that we're able to sort of, you know, get everyone on the same page and around the information that we have.
Well, and speaking of partners, Dr. Daly, can you tell us about the partnership the state has with CVS and Walgreens? They were supposed to be the key partners, right, in getting the vaccine to long-term care facilities. So how happy have you been with that partnership?
Yes. So the Federal Long-Term Care Facility Pharmacy Partnership Program was stood up by the federal government in order to make vaccines available to our very vulnerable long-term care facility residents and staff. And so that program has been up and running since the very beginning here in New Hampshire. You know, they've vaccinated over 100 facilities at this point. CVS and Walgreens are the ones who are providing these services in our state. And they've been working with the different long-term care facilities to establish these clinics to go into them, provide those first doses. They're going back into them even now to provide second doses, and then to have those partnerships going forward to make sure that those very vulnerable facilities do have access to vaccine. We're certainly there as a safety net as well. You know, not every facility in our state signed up through that program, but most did. So if they didn't sign up through the program, we'll work with them with the regional public health networks in our state to make sure that they can access vaccine. So we've been monitoring the program very closely. They, like I said, have done over 100 facilities at this point in our state, and they still have more work to do and are rolling out that program.
So CVS and Walgreens, then, correct me if I'm wrong, Dr. Daly, were selected as the long-term care partners from the federal government. Is that what you're saying?
That's correct. It's a federal program. We don't have any contractual relationship, or we're not part of that relationship between those entities and the CDC. The CDC, you know, is interested in setting up these additional relationships with the pharmacies in order to have one additional avenue or mechanism to get vaccine out in the states, while we're also working internally within our state on our own plans as well. So it was meant to be an additional resource so that we didn't have to worry about taking care of those facilities. As you know, in New Hampshire, our long-term care facilities have been very heavily impacted. And so they certainly were a priority for us. And we gave all of the vaccine that we were required to give to that program so that it could get up and running as quickly as possible in our state.
How happy are you with that partnership? How good a job do you think CVS and Walgreens have been doing? Because NHPR has reported that it's been sort of bumpy, and in West Virginia, where the state took control of long-term care facilities, the rate of vaccination has been much higher.
Yeah, you know, I think that they are working very hard to make the program work. And like all of us, you know, no one has responded to a pandemic before or had to establish these types of programs. So certainly, I think we would have liked the program to roll out a little quicker. And you'll hear, you know, you'll hear that type of feedback from some of the facilities, you know, wondering where they're at in the scheduling and is there any possibility, you know, to get done quicker. So it's definitely been, there have definitely been some challenges overall. You know, the experience that we've heard from the facilities who've had these pharmacies come in is that once they're on the ground in the facility, they've had, you know, good experience with the pharmacists and the staff that are coming in to perform those clinics. But I think by and large, you know, the biggest concern is just, can it be done any quicker than it can, that it has been done?
Well, lots of questions from listeners already coming in. Again, our number 800-892-6477. And our email is exchange@nhpr.org. And listeners, we're talking about vaccine distribution today as the state prepares to enter a big new phase of vaccination for a wider population of Granite Staters. We welcome your questions by email, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or call 800-892-6477. And Kirsten, Dr. Daly, already lots of questions. Let's go to Ellen in Amherst. Go ahead, Ellen, you're on the air. Welcome. Thanks for calling today.
Sure, thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Yep.
Awesome. So I'm a teacher in Amherst. I actually own a preschool here, and I'm also on the school board. So it comes to say I'm an advocate for teachers, and a frustration certainly that I had when the governor announced that teachers were going to be taken out of the 1B that the CDC recommended. I decided to start a petition and see what the voters of New Hampshire felt. So that was last Thursday, and we're already up to almost 8,000 signatures. And I just wanted to call and support my fellow teachers and really let everybody know how challenging this is, not only for teachers, but also for school districts. When there's an exposure for a teacher who's in person, we lose that teacher for a couple of weeks, and getting substitutes, as you can imagine, during this pandemic is challenging, if not impossible. And I think that reason is one of the reasons that teachers should be added back into 1B, but also because our population cannot be vaccinated. You know, kids under 16 cannot be vaccinated. And so our population doesn't see, you know, that we don't see that vaccine coming down the pike for our customers, as we will call them, maybe our students. And so protecting teachers seems even that much more important. And of course, we all know, we've read the articles, we've seen many, many interviews that in-person school is really what's best for kids. This remote learning is challenging for children, for students, and certainly for families. So I just want to advocate again and let everybody know that on change.org, you can find our petition to get teachers in New Hampshire back to the phase 1B.
Well, I'd like to ask about teachers. And Kirsten, you mentioned earlier that you were looking at and trying to explain as part of your job how people get in different categories, how those categories are decided. Our caller is right. New Hampshire is one of just a few states that has not put teachers earlier in the line. So tell us more about that, please.
Sure. So we've had a, so first of all, let me thank Ellen for her question. I think there's no, you know, there's no challenge to everything that she said. I think we're also incredibly concerned about teachers and those of us who are parents with students in school, you know, are very concerned about moving our children back to in-person learning and recognize that that is, you know, that is the place that we want them to be. You know, I think that our allocation process has been a very long process, as it has been for every state. And we, you know, really looked at multiple criteria, multiple issues. Our 1B phase eventually landed in a place where we were most focused on those who were at highest risk for the most severe outcome related to COVID-19, so very severe morbidity or mortality or death. And so in that way, we needed to elevate to 1B the populations that were really at most significant risk. And some of that, most of that was led by our data. And so I think right now the goal is to, and I'll allow, you know, I'll ask Dr. Daly to fill this in, but I think the goal right now is to move as quickly as we can through 1B and to be able to get on to some of the other also highly vulnerable populations and critical populations for reasons other than severe, you know, health outcomes related to COVID-19. So we have social and cultural reasons to want to vaccinate, populations like teachers who are a critical infrastructure of our communities, who play such an important role in ensuring that our children feel safe and connected, and that parents have a place, a safe and place to send their children so they're able to go to work. So these are, there is very few populations, if any, that do not play some critical role in keeping our, you know, our social structure, keeping our communities moving in some way or another. So I'm gonna, I will hand it over to Dr. Daly to see if she has any more insight.
Yeah, Dr. Daly, go ahead. I wanted to ask you about this too. This has been controversial. There's been a lot of rhetoric about get the kids back in school. So why not bump the teachers up?
Yeah, so first I just want to acknowledge that we've received a lot of advocacy from many, many different groups who want to be earlier in the phased allocation of vaccine. And so certainly we agree with many of them that they should absolutely get the vaccine. We want them to get vaccinated. The problem is that we do not have enough vaccine to do everybody that should get vaccinated early in our state. And so we have to make those difficult decisions. And where our allocation strategy is coming from is really from saving the perspective of saving lives. You know, we want those people who are over the age of 65 and older to access the vaccine. That's who's dying in our state. You know, 94% of the deaths that have occurred occur in this population. And then certainly those who are medically vulnerable, and any teachers who meet those criteria should absolutely get vaccinated. But in fact, you know, teachers have been prioritized in our plan. There's no other group in our state. There's so many essential workers, right? There's no other group other than first responders and health workers who have been called out in this way to receive early access to the vaccine, rather than just basing it simply on age and medical vulnerability. So just acknowledging that there is a lot of advocacy in our state, and they're right. They're right that they should get the vaccine, and we want them to have the vaccine as quickly as possible too.
Well, and here's another question, Dr. Daly, from a listener about another category of people. Kent asks, why are grocery store workers not a vaccine priority? They're front-facing essential services that can be COVID hotspots. Employees with some risk factors are captive because they're economically vulnerable and would lose unemployment benefits if they quit. Kent, thank you for writing. And Dr. Daly, can you address that?
Yes, thank you. So again, we agree they should get vaccinated. We want them to get vaccinated. There's not enough vaccine to go around. If you look at the essential worker list that CDC refers to, you know, almost half the workers in our state, probably more than that, are going to fall under one of these essential sectors. So going from the making decisions from that perspective of essential workers and public contact and risk is not going to put us in a place that we can actually carry out our strategy of vaccinating people, because there's just too many people. And again, our goal is to save lives. And so we have taken this approach of looking at age and medical risk. And if you're a grocery store worker who falls into this phase 1B category, please sign up to get vaccinated.
Yeah, well, again, so many people. And as you said earlier, Dr. Daly, not enough vaccine, again, especially given the disappointing news that the supply is not what was promised. So thank you again for writing in. Here's another question from Maddie, who raises an issue that I wanted to ask you about, Kirsten. Maddie says, my husband and I just moved from phase 2A to 1B. What I noticed, at least for 1A, is a unique phone number is required for each registrant. Will that be a requirement for 1B? My husband and I share a single cell phone number. Our landline doesn't accept text messages? Are there provisions for joint appointments for qualifying members of a household? I have a couple other questions also from listeners, Kirsten, along this line. You know, people who don't have great internet access, no internet access, maybe they don't have a cell phone, maybe they're sharing one cell phone. So can you just address those folks, Kirsten, who don't have traditional, just automatically go online, sign up, no problem?
Sure. So this is, you know, this is, we anticipate that this will be an issue for a lot of people that don't have good internet access or simply don't use technology for various reasons. So people who do, of course, can go online and register. People who don't can call 211. And what we can say is that we will find a way to make this work for everybody. And one of the things that, you know, that I think, again, going back to what I had said earlier, is we continue to work with different advocacy groups, and we will continue to push information out. So as we hear more information about, well, this, you know, what were different barriers for people to be able to sign up, or if they were able to sign up to be able to make it to an appointment, or you know, various different things, we'll continue to push out new processes and new information to meet those needs. So we would encourage people to, when the time comes for their phase, to call the 211 number if they're not comfortable with technology. If they don't have access to a telephone, or if they they don't feel comfortable speaking on the telephone for whatever reason, we would ask them to connect with their own medical provider. If they don't have a medical provider, then we're going to begin to push out information to other advocacy groups, and you know, we'll hope that we will capture everybody that way. So we ask, you know, it's an incredibly trying time. Dr. Daly had mentioned earlier that, you know, we are in our first response to a pandemic, certainly a pandemic of this magnitude lasting for this long. So we are figuring out tools and responses as we go. I think we have a fairly good system in place that is going to capture most people, but there certainly are, you know, intricacies of the system that are not going to work for everybody. And so we are going to figure that out as we move along. So I would encourage this family to use the 211 number and work with them to get what they need.
Okay, well, along these lines, coming up after a short break, we're going to talk about vaccination efforts here in New Hampshire among communities of color. As you both know, Black and brown communities have been especially hard hit by this pandemic. So we'll talk about efforts to reach out to those folks to get them vaccinated when there is enough vaccine available. That's the other question at play here. And we'll keep taking your questions. So stay with us. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
As a small business, we have always prioritized our underwriting for an HPR as one of the primary marketing investments that we make.
Jim Fitz, Managing Director of the Colony Group, a longtime business supporter of an HPR.
We find that our clients appreciate that support, and also we frequently hear that an HPR is where they first hear our name.
You can learn more on how to reach NHPR's statewide audience at nhpr.org/underwrite.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, COVID-19 vaccine distribution. The state is on the verge of a new phase in this process, getting ready to sign up Granite Staters over age 65, among others, for vaccination, for a total of nearly 300,000 people eligible. We're finding out how this process is rolling out, some concerns about the supply of vaccines provided by the federal government, and we've been taking your questions. Send them in by email, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or call 800 1-800-892-6477. We have two guests, Dr. Beth Daly, Chief of the Bureau of Infectious Disease Control at the Department of Health and Human Services. Also, Kirsten Dersey, she's the Bureau's evaluator, and she's a member of the governor's equity response team to the pandemic. And both of you, here's a question from Sarah that came in. She says, is anyone thinking about holding vaccine clinics in places where various immigrant communities feel safe? Places like churches or community centers where the staff and volunteers are linguistically and culturally competent and diverse. And Sarah, thank you for the email. That's an important question that I want to ask both of you about, but Kirsten, you first, please.
Yes. So yes, we are. And thank you, Sarah, for that important question. I think, and I hope that it's become, you know, evident to everybody as we've moved through this pandemic that one thing that we've known for a long time, and this is not unique to infectious disease or pandemics in particular, or COVID-19, is that, you know, disease and does not affect everybody equally. So, you know, what we've seen in this pandemic is that there are some populations that have been significantly disproportionately impacted. And that is not unique to New Hampshire, that is the same around the country. And so what we've seen in particular is that communities of color have had a much higher rate of infection, a much higher rate of hospitalization. And so it becomes really important for us to think about ways to specifically mitigate that impact. So if we're talking about populations that have already been significantly marginalized in lots of different ways, maybe without access to resources, who might be living or working in difficult or vulnerable conditions, who may have a language barrier or a transportation barrier. And then we layer on top of it an infectious disease, a pandemic that is impacting their population and their communities at a much higher rate. We have a really, really significant problem to address. And so one way that we are doing that is we are following in our allocation plan, we are following guidance that was laid out from a couple different sources, including the National Academies of Science, that indicate that one way to think about mitigating this impact is to set aside a portion of the allocation to be moved specifically to highly vulnerable communities. And the governor has talked about this, and I've been very pleased to hear him speak about this openly and publicly, that we have to address our highly vulnerable communities. And one of those communities is our communities of color here in New Hampshire. And so a few things that we will be doing, we'll be working through each. Our state has 13 public health regions. They align not exactly, but closely to our counties. And our public health regions have public health regional networks that work within them. And we'll be working with them to really place vaccine clinics in places where our most vulnerable populations are. And we know that down to the census tract. So we'll be working in our sort of most vulnerable places in our state and then moving outward and hopefully moving into eventually every area of the state and moving vaccine there. So yes, one of those things will be identifying locations that are walkable to people that we need to vaccinate. That ensuring that there are interpreters on site, that information is available in languages that people speak and understand. And that, you know, it's a really culturally responsive way to meet people's needs. And part of that definitely, too, is addressing in advance some of the vaccination fears and hesitancy that may exist in different populations.
Working like, sounds like you're really trying to focus on those groups within the community mm-hmm. that people can walk to, Kirsten, so in case yep. they have transportation problems, linguistic help and so forth. So addressing the the fears that some people might have. And you seem to be going into the area of vaccine hesitancy. So go ahead, Kirsten. How would you describe the status of vaccine hesitancy among these communities in particular? National polls show Black Americans, Latinx Americans say they're less likely to accept vaccine.
Yeah. Yes, and we know that to be the case in New Hampshire as well. Some of our local polling tells us that may be the case here as well. And that's not unexpected. We certainly have, I think, you know, part of what we need to do in public health and part of what we've done, and I think that one of the things that this pandemic has really brought to light is our need to acknowledge and grapple with our own history in public health and healthcare. And part of that has really been the way that we have treated and mistreated communities of color in particular. And some of these, many of them, in fact, have been tied to efforts that people may be familiar with, like the Tuskegee trials. So, you know, so in our communities of color now, that whether that these interventions that were mistreating vulnerable people were recent or in long ago past history, it doesn't much matter. These are the memories that live for a long time in communities. And so there is a reasonable mistrust and fear. And I think that, you know, if we don't talk about it, if we don't acknowledge our own role in it, and then work hard to sort of unpack it and make it better and earn back the trust that we may have lost over many, many years and generations, then we're certainly not going to be able to help the populations that we feel are at very, very high risk access the vaccine that they need. And well, so one of the things that we've been doing is holding community education sessions, community listening sessions sometimes where, you know, people can come and talk about things that they've heard. And, you know, things that they've heard, things that they're afraid of, things that they are concerned about. And we can share the information that we have in an open and transparent conversation. And also hear from people, what is it we need to do to make you feel safe and make you want to get vaccinated, make you come to the clinic? And then we have to do the work of doing those things.
Well, and if listeners aren't familiar with the Tuskegee incident that you mentioned, Kirsten, that's in the mid-1900s, Black men in Tuskegee, Alabama were deliberately not treated for syphilis. So researchers could observe disease progression, and the legacy of that continues today. Dr. Daly, I have a lot of questions from listeners that are very practical. So I'm going to throw a couple of them at you, please, just about how this is going to happen. People do seem excited about the opportunity to at least sign up. So here's an email from Kathy who says, can the website handle the amount of people who are going to try and access it at 8 a.m. on the 22nd? Kathy says, will there be vaccines available for the second shot? How do people sign up for that? And here's another good question from Kathy. Although there will be appointments, how can long lines be avoided so we don't risk catching COVID while waiting in line to get the shot? So Kathy, thank you for writing. And that first question first, I guess, Dr. Daly, can the website handle the amount of people who are going to try and jump on the 22nd?
Yes, great. So those are all great questions. And I'm, you know, happy and excited to talk about how we're rolling this out. So the website, you know, we're certainly working with our information technology partners to make sure that the website can handle the volume. You know, we feel confident in the technology that we're standing up for the registration process. So, you know, I don't have a crystal ball and can't say 100% that nothing bad is going to happen, but we have all resources on this program right now. And I feel confident that it's going to handle the volume.
How many appointment slots, Dr. Daly, will be released on Friday? Do you know?
So we have a number of different sites where people can get vaccinated, and you know, we've stood up these state-run fixed sites that are available at 13 different locations across the state. When those are at full capacity, they can handle up to 25,000 vaccinations per week. We've been ramping up that capacity. Obviously, we don't have enough vaccine to provide that number of vaccinations. So it can handle the, it will be able to, that infrastructure can handle the amount of vaccine that we have coming into the state. Again, we only have 17,000 doses coming in. So we'll have less than that in terms of appointment spots, because as you heard from Kirsten, we are setting aside about 10% of that allocation to be able to go out into the communities and reach those vulnerable populations. And so not all of the vaccine is going to those sites, but most of it will.
And for people who can't make an appointment, Dr. Daly, and it sounds like a lot of people will be disappointed on that first day, given that you aren't getting the allocation you expected, are people's names going to be on a wait list, or do you have to continually check back with the website?
No, everybody can go ahead and register on that website, and they will be able to schedule. What will happen is they'll enter their information in the system, and then they will receive an invitation via email, and hopefully they have email. If not, again, we have a process in place to be able to take that information over the phone and register them into a spot. But if they have an email, they'll receive an email invitation that will provide them with the information about where the clinics are to look at the schedule and see when they can get their slot. And so those appointments will be open out over several weeks so that they can get in a spot at that time.
So that's a question. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, sorry,
Dr. Daly. No waiting list. They'll go into our registration system and be able to register once they work through that process.
Again, our email address is exchange@nhpr.org. You can use Facebook, or you can give us a call at 800-892-6477. Dr. Daly, I've got lots of questions from listeners about joint signups. And I know I asked you one of those earlier, but people are still asking about how they can sign up together. Here's one from Beth, who says, when sign up for 65 and older becomes available on Friday, will I be able to sign my husband and myself up at the same time, meaning we would go together to the same location at the same time? I don't know if you can answer that specific question, Dr. Daly. You don't know her particular providers and all that, but we are getting lots of questions from people about joint signups.
Yeah, that's great. And I think that's one of the benefits of coming on shows like this, so we can hear the feedback from the public in this way and what's important to them. You know, we have not talked specifically about this process of signing up your entire family to come through one of our fixed sites. So I think this is good feedback to have. What's going to happen as you move through the registration process is you'll be able to access the schedule, and you might be able to pick the same or, you know, adjacent time slots in the scheduling. Obviously, we schedule multiple people at the same time because our throughput is so high, you know, we can put through a lot of people within a single hour. And so that is possible. I think that you can also call 211 to schedule in that particular scenario. So I'm certainly going to go back to our team here and talk about what planning we've done around this and how we might be able to support those individuals and see if we can proactively push out some information on that topic for all of you. And again, appreciate the feedback. I did want to proactively address one of the questions I think I heard, which was about safety of coming to a vaccination site. You know, sure. Our state-run sites operate as a drive-through, and so you're not going to be standing in line. We have scheduled the right number of people to be there that we can handle with the throughput, and you'll be in your car.
So the state's fixed sites, those are drive-through sites. And I've seen one of those here in Concord up at the Steeplegate Mall where you stay in your car. But as doctor's offices and clinics start getting involved in this, I'm guessing, Dr. Daly, you can correct me if I'm wrong, that they will try to enforce, you know, social distancing, spacing people out, wearing masks and so forth.
Absolutely. And, you know, even a number of our healthcare providers right now, we want to push vaccine to locations that have very high a throughput. And so those locations are looking at very similar models where they might be doing drive-throughs as well. So, but yes, if anyone's having any type of clinic that's indoors and involves people coming into the facility, they will be having those types of procedures in place to make sure that people are not exposing. And of course, you shouldn't go get vaccinated if you're sick or on quarantine anyhow. You should wait until you're isolation or quarantine period is over before you come to get vaccinated.
Lots more questions from our listeners, but we have to take a very quick break. So when we come back, we'll go right back to your comments, questions, concerns. And we'll also talk about the people in this that are younger than 65, but may also be included in this new group that's eligible to sign up on Friday. So we'll talk about that after a short break. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
As a small business, we really like to support the community around us, and we feel that NHPR is a very important part of New Hampshire's community.
Lydia West of Goose Bay Lumber of Chichester is a proud NHPR underwriter.
Goose Bay is a really small business with very limited advertising dollars, but with NHPR, not only do we reach our customer base, it feels good to be able to support NHPR.
Join NHPR's growing community of underwriters at nhpr.org/underwrite.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. This hour, the Granite State's vaccination campaign prepares to enter a new phase. By Friday, a huge new group of people becomes eligible to sign up for vaccines, including everybody over age 65. We're taking your questions. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Our number, 800-892-6477. And Dr. Beth Daly and Kirsten Dersey, right back to our listeners. Let's take Steve calling in from Portsmouth. Go ahead, Steve. You're on the air. Welcome. Steve, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
The bottom one makes noise.
Okay. I think Steve is busy, and that's fine. I get it. Everybody's working. Pamela in Moultonboro is also with us. Go ahead, Pamela.
Good morning. My husband and I are 68 and 70. We had 3 weeks of very symptomatic COVID, and both were obviously positive. We've been symptom-free now for 6 weeks, and we neither of us have any comorbidities. We're both quite healthy. So I have two questions around that. One is, should we sign up for the vaccine, given that there are so many other people that seem so much more vulnerable? And if there's anything known about how long we will have these antibodies, my second question or comment is, one subgroup that hasn't been mentioned yet are people that are incarcerated who, for obvious reasons, don't have even the most minimal protection against social distancing or any type of COVID protection. And their rates are exponentially higher all over the country. And I'll take my answers off the air. Thanks.
Well, Pamela, thank you. And to your first questions about immunity and so forth, I'm going to save those for our show tomorrow, Pamela, because we have Dr. Chan and Dr. Talbot on tomorrow, and they are really watching the sort of scientific and medical implications of this virus and the vaccine. But to your second point about prisoners, Dr. Daly, can you address Pamela's point about how prisoners are falling under the state's vaccination plan?
Sure. Yes. So, you know, she's absolutely right. There are challenges in that setting regarding social distancing, and we have had some outbreaks occurring in correctional facilities. So it's absolutely a setting that we are concerned about. The way that the people who reside in a correctional facility will get vaccinated is according to the allocation plan that's been laid out based on medical and age risk. And so we'll be working with the correctional facilities to make sure that they can access vaccine for their resident population, as well as for their staff and correctional facility officers. So they can get vaccinated, the staff who work there. And then as their residents become eligible based on the state allocation framework, those residents can go ahead and get vaccinated as well. So if they have residents that are 65 and older, or have those medical comorbidities, they'll be able to start getting vaccinated starting next week.
I've gotten some other questions on this too, Dr. Daly, around the idea that other populations living in congregate settings, like people with disabilities, like older people in nursing homes, they are getting vaccinated just by virtue of the fact that they live in congregate settings, and these viruses spread, as you just said. So why not vaccinate prisoners, given that they also live in group facilities?
So those congregate settings that have been prioritized is really due to their age and medical risk. Again, it's long-term care facilities and those facilities that house persons with intellectual and developmental disabilities. And the vaccine is being made available to them, not simply because they live in congregate setting, but because they are at increased risk due to their age and medical vulnerability. So other congregate settings that are out there are not being specially vaccinated according to our plan. You can think of colleges and universities, residential schools. There's no special carve out for other types of congregate settings.
I also have a question from someone, and Kirsten, I'll throw this to you, about homeless populations and how the state is looking at addressing vaccination for that vulnerable group.
Yeah, so thank you for the question. That's a really important population that we've been talking about a lot over the last weeks. How are we, you know, because this is a population that that is highly vulnerable for various reasons, but also their access to some of the vaccination routes that we have opened is limited at best. So they may not have transportation. They may not have a medical provider. They may not, have access to all of the things that we need in place, technology to be able to get an appointment for a vaccination and go to a site. Now we do have our fixed sites who will be open to anybody. But I think that this is a part of the population that we consider highly vulnerable. That we will, eventually try to move through some of our really targeted efforts in community. And so we continue conversations with the advocacy groups and the groups that work directly with people who are housing insecure or who are homeless. And so to begin to think about ways that we can move outward and really meet the people that that really need vaccination but aren't going to be able to take advantage of the systems that we have set up currently.
Here's another email from a listener, and this is an important question that several people have asked. Dr. Daly, I'll throw it to you. So we've been talking about the 65 plus group, but this new group that's eligible to register also includes other people, including people who have two or more medical conditions. And this person asks, what is the process to register for the vaccine if you're under 65 but have medical conditions? Do you just sign up on Friday like everyone else? That's a good question, because how do you sort of prove you have those medical conditions, Dr. Daly, when you're filling out an online form?
Yes, great question. So those individuals who are under the age of 65 will require medical verification from their healthcare provider to confirm that they do meet the eligibility criteria. So again, very simple, if you're 65 and older, go to that website to sign up. Otherwise, you're gonna be looking for information from your healthcare provider around how they are managing this medical verification process. Many of the healthcare organizations are starting to message their patients, letting them know how they're managing this. I know personally, I've received messaging from my healthcare provider around this subject. And so you'll wanna be looking for information from them. Certainly we wanna be careful not to overwhelm or inundate our healthcare provider offices with phone calls asking for that medical verification. So I think if you could be patient, at least for a few days here, since registration hasn't even opened yet, your health provider should be reaching out to you if you're not part of a major, medical organization, and you have a small primary care provider office that you go to or something like that, you could potentially reach out to them. But again, I'd give them a few days here to let them message you first and share information proactively with how they're managing this process. But certainly, eventually, you're going to have to go through your healthcare provider in order to get that verification. And then they'll let us know at the state that you have been verified, and that then we'll reach out and schedule you.
I see. Okay, so an extra step for those folks who are under age 65, but defined as medically vulnerable. They first have to get sort of certification from their provider saying, yes, this person is vulnerable, and yes, this person deserves, you know, an earlier place in line for the shot. Is that right, Dr. Daly?
They will be part of phase 1B, right? Just to say that it doesn't necessarily, they're not going to be put above in front of as anyone else that's also in line, right? So in terms of the earlier spot, I just want to clarify, we're treating the phase 1B population the same. If you're over the age of 65 or older or medically vulnerable, you're going to kind of come into the queue and get a spot to get registered.
Okay, and that answers a question that we got from Barbara also, who wants to know about people under 65 with two or more conditions. And you just explained, Dr. Daly, about how those folks can sign up. By the way, if you're listening and you haven't caught all the information, and there is a lot, we always put all sorts of links and resources on our web posts for the day, and that is nhpr.org/exchange. Again, nhpr.org/exchange. Here's an interesting email from Sheila, and Kirsten, I'll throw this to you. Sheila says, I'm over 75 and privileged to live by myself. It's not fun, but I can quarantine easily. Could I trade off and give my spot in line to a person of color, especially a teacher? Kirsten?
Let me just acknowledge what a gracious offer that is from Sheila. What I want to tell Sheila and everyone else is that we are working incredibly hard, not just the Division of Public Health Services, but the Public Health Regional Networks, all of our partners on the ground, all of our medical providers across the state, and many, many grassroots organizations are working really hard to ensure that we will capture everybody who needs to be vaccinated. We're dedicated to do this. It is our job. It is our responsibility, and we will do it. What I also want to say is that I think that one of the things that has become increasingly clear, and I hope it has become clear to a lot of people, is that our health is inextricably linked now. Your health, Laura, is linked with my health is linked with Dr. Daly's, and all of our healths are linked to Sheila's. So it's really critical that people get vaccinated in the phase that they are able to get vaccinated in. We really need as many people to get vaccinated as possible to ensure that we can protect everybody in our state.
Oh, that's interesting. So to Sheila's point, she wants to give it to someone who's more vulnerable, Kirsten, but you're saying, just by virtue of the fact that Sheila gets vaccinated, that helps everybody. That seems to
be
your basic point.
Absolutely. Yes, we are. This is a group. This is really the ultimate group effort, I believe. Yes.
Dr. Daly, what did you learn from the first phase of vaccinations for healthcare workers and sort of frontline first responders? What did you learn from that phase that you're now going to try to put into place for this next new, bigger phase?
That is a great question. So, you know, we want to, I think, proactively message individuals about the efficacy and safety of these vaccines. So certainly as we rolled out the vaccine, we saw a range of responses from potential vaccine recipients. Some people, as you have heard, they want the vaccine, you know, they're demanding it. They want to be at the front of the line. Then you have other people who absolutely do not want the vaccine. And then you have a lot of people who are in the middle and they're unsure and they need information. So I think over time, thinking back in the early days when the vaccine was first being offered, for example, to our healthcare providers, you know, there was some hesitancy there, but it's increased, you know, over time as people see their friends and coworkers get vaccinated and that it's that this vaccine is safe, they, you know, have wanted the vaccine more and more. So I think that's definitely some messaging that we're working on getting out there is that, you know, there have been many medical researchers working on these vaccines. And we are, you know, pleasantly surprised with how effective they are, 95% effective. That's amazing. And we're really excited about it. And that these vaccines are safe, just like all of the other vaccines that we get. There are reactions. You should expect the swelling pain, redness at the injection site. You could feel tired, have muscle body aches. Some people even develop a fever after it. This is not COVID-19. These vaccines cannot give you COVID-19, but these are reactions that your body is experiencing because the vaccine is working. They're indicating that your body is mounting an immune response to the vaccine and developing those antibodies that are going to protect you. So I think that's what we've learned, is just to make sure that we're getting all this really helpful messaging out there and that people feel informed and feel good about the vaccine and that they want to take it, especially in these very vulnerable populations that we're talking about, these groups we're doing in phase 1B who are at increased risk for dying from COVID-19. So we want them to feel confident as well about the safety and efficacy of these vaccines so that we can get great uptake and then move on to through the rest of our phases that we also want to get to.
So if we can move on to those phases, if there's enough vaccine, what are you watching, Dr. Daly? And I'm sorry to ask you to make this quick, but what are you watching in terms of that critical supply? You can sign up all the people in the world, but if you don't have the shots, you can't do it.
Absolutely. You know, we want additional vaccine formulations to come on so that we can increase the number of vaccines that we have access to. And we're hopeful that the manufacturers we do have increase their production. And that's really our limiting factor right now. We have a lot of capacity in our state. Our healthcare providers are willing to come to the table and provide these vaccines to their patients and the public. And we just need the vaccine to be able to do it.
All right. Dr. Daly, it's been really good to talk to you this morning. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's Dr. Beth Daly, Chief of the Bureau of Infectious Disease Control, and Kirsten Dursey. Good to have you too. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Laura.
That's Kirsten Dursey. She's an evaluator at the Bureau and a member of the Governor's Equity Response Team. Now, for more medical and scientific aspects of the vaccine and of the pandemic in general, we do have Dr. Chan and Dr. Talbot on our show tomorrow. They are our state's top epidemiologists. So you can get your questions in for them as well. In advance, as always, exchange@nhpr.org. Today's show was produced by Exchange producer Jane Vaughn. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.